Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Accelerate series. I'm your host, Adam Chen. The startup world is moving at a breakneck pace. For seed stage founders, the goalposts aren't just moving, the entire field is being redesigned. Between the explosion of AI native architectures and the shifting benchmarks of venture capital, building a company today requires a new kind of playbook. This special Accelerate series is dedicated to the stories and challenges of early stage builders and what drives them to innovate. We're sitting down with founders who are navigating the chaos, hitting their milestones, and redefining what it means to be a venture scale company in the age of AI. Whether you're looking for inspiration from other founders or just want to understand the latest expectations in the early stage, you're in the right place. Now, on to the show. And welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Accelerate Series podcast. I'm your host, Adam Chen, and joining me today, we have the founder and CEO of Total Family, Alex Kirby. Alex, welcome to the show. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Founder of Total Family. We're a software that is used mostly by wealth advisors, family offices, and families to do legacy work. I think the thing that is unique about us is how we define legacy. We don't do anything related to financial or legal or tax. Our version of legacy is about the humans involved in the legacy, their stories, their values, the history of families. So I think, like, because of that, we found a lot of great partners in the wealth space that wanted to do this work, know it's important, but just weren't really sure how to do it. And I think most importantly, do it at scale.
Interesting. So wealth managers, maybe you can help me understand a little bit more. Tell me more about, you know, what's in it, I guess, for the wealth manager. Where is the value of maybe some of this, the stories, the narratives, the values that you just mentioned? How does that add to their business?
Yeah, well, I mean, we tell them right now, like, no one really owns legacy, right? So you're not, your primary care physician isn't bringing it up during your physical kind of thing. And so they're already having these conversations that are tiptoeing around legacy in a lot of ways. You know, they're talking about money, they're talking about grandkids, they're talking about all these vehicles that are going to be in trust and last multiple generations and all of this stuff. So they're right there. But then when you get into what is sometimes referred to the softer stuff, which we think more as the human stuff, they're just not totally equipped to have those conversations, even though they really want to have them. And so I think for wealth advisors, the big sort of train that's coming for them is the great wealth transfer and all this money moving from one generation to the next.
Sure.
You know, it's a big business problem because if you're on average, they're losing like somewhere between 50 and 80% of these assets when they transfer. So that's a really big business problem. It's easier to keep the assets while you have them. And you need a way to connect to these families multi-generationally so that the assets don't leave. And I think we're already seeing from these younger generations, this stuff isn't unimportant to them. It's very important. You know, if you find someone who's like under 45, they want to talk about their values. They want to understand the history of the family and how they got here. And maybe contrast that with like some of the older generations who kept things like a little closer to the vest.
Oh, sure.
But that group that has embraced mental health and a lot of these services in a different way understands legacy without us even really having to explain it too much.
You know, you mentioned earlier too that, you know, the human side of things, I suppose, right? Or the what maybe people call the softer side. I mean, I would argue maybe it's the harder stuff, maybe said another way. I mean, you've got wealth managers, not to put them in too much of a bucket, but these are like facts and figures guys, right? Or gals, right? These are numbers people. And I can see the challenge of doing some of the more emotional and human kind of conversation stuff. So I'm curious, what about you, your background, your experience that inspired you to kind of try to bridge this divide?
Well, I mean, if I was talking to like a psychologist, it would probably be the fact that I was an only child with 10 step and half siblings. So a total of 6 marriages, 5 divorces, middle class upbringing. Everyone was wonderful and very loving, and you know, a good complicated family. And I think I was working under the impression maybe for a while that money would have solved a lot of these resources. I worked at a commercial bank and got a chance to work with middle market companies that had lots of money and generational wealth. And when I looked at them, they just looked and sounded a lot like my family. And that was the first time that there a kind of light went off that, all right, money doesn't necessarily solve these problems. I don't think money necessarily makes them worse either. I think there's like a perception that, like, you know, money will ruin people and all this type of stuff. But for the most part, if you had to pick between having no financial resources and having financial resources, you would take the resources, right? And then I learned about, there's a gentleman by the name of James E. Hughes, wrote a book called Complete Family Wealth. He's written a number of books, but his idea is called the Five Forms of Family Capital. And that's the framework that we really embrace. Jay's kind of epiphany was that the true wealth of a family is their well-being, and financial capital is just a small component of it. And so once I saw that framework, that sort of put me on like a 10-year odyssey of learning about it, doing a lot of market research over the first 2 to 3 years of this company to see what really clicked with people and real families and real high net worth families. And then eventually building the software that was going to let people do this in a way that just acknowledged that families are busy and that was practical. You know, I have three little boys, and so I consider myself to be very busy. And if it didn't work for me, or if it didn't work for the other people in the company, who many of them are also parents, maybe contrast that with, like, there's a lot of Wall Street Journal stories of 3-day family retreats and 7-day family retreats that not only are huge time commitments but cost a lot of money. That just doesn't work for most people that we've talked to, and we were looking for something that could work for almost everyone.
I love that. I love that. The accessibility matters. As you mentioned, it's not just high net worth folks. I would suppose that care about family stories and legacy. It's truly anyone, middle
Yeah,
class.
I mean, most of those people don't have wealth advisors anyway, but most of the people that have wealth advisors care about this stuff in some way, shape, or form. They want to learn more about their parents, tell a story to their kids, understand their history better, define their values. These things have almost nothing to do with money. And the reason that it's sort of there is because the prior ways of delivering legacy were mostly consultants in front of whiteboards. And consultants in front of whiteboards, as you know, are expensive. And it's really, really hard to scale. But if you can find a way to bring it to more people, we're just seeing so many people lean in to this work, totally irrespective of how much money they have. I mean, there are people that have hundreds of millions of dollars that love this work too. But if you're a, you know, a second gen immigrant doctor with more med school debt than assets, I think you still are interested in what your parents did to get you to that point, and what your grandparents did to set them up, and what decisions they had to make. And, you know, did they have, was it all wonderful, or did they ever have any tough times? And what can you learn about the tough times that they went through to help you get through your own, and build sort of that family legacy? Like the families, the only families we really know about, are like the big, huge American dynasties, right? And it's because they had the resources to do that type of stuff. But I think we see a world where 50 and 100 years from now, even if you don't have dynastic wealth, you can still have an understanding of like what your great grandparents were like, and what they did to help you, because none of us do this alone.
So that resonates. I not to be morbid here, but I read these articles, of people on their deathbed and what are their regrets in life, right? And yes, money is important. I'm not denying that, but like Often in these narratives, you hear it's, I wish I had more time with family, with friends. It's the human connection piece. And I'm just curious, with the advent of AI and the, the domination of social media, like we're losing some of that humanity a bit. And I'm really curious, how and why I'm really excited talking to you is how technology can maybe bring some of that back. So I'm curious, there is a question here. I am curious, like, what is your vision and what does success look like in this space for you?
Well, I mean, the AI piece is interesting. Like, AI doesn't know how your parents met. And to me, there's an element of getting this information out of people and getting them to AI can't. AI can write a letter to your parents or to your children, but I don't know if it's the letter that you would have written,
Sure.
right? And so to me, like, AI can be helpful if you think about having all of this legacy stuff in one place, and then maybe there's an AI that can help inform later generations of the story of your family in a more concise way. Like, that AI might actually know how your parents met, but not if we never get the information out of people. But I think for us, the purpose of our company is doing legacy better. When we talk about purpose, purpose to us is your North Star. It's not something that you achieve, it's something that you aspire to. And so when we talk about purpose, the people in the company that talk about purpose, it's about just continually chipping away at that journey, making it accessible for people, making it clearer. I don't really know what legacy is going to look like in 50 years, but I hope we've made some progress on that statistic of 53% of Americans not being able to name their grandparents. I hope people feel more connected, to their heritage, and then I hope the stuff that they're doing today is can help the generations that come after us. But to us, it's a huge problem, legacy. And we don't know if that means more product in innovation. We don't know if that means like going through different channels. We don't really know, but that's the North Star for us, is doing legacy better. And we use that terminology with families too, because we have both individuals and families create purpose statements. And same thing, it's aspirational. And if you look at any really good governance, it starts with purpose. You have to know the big overarching North Star of what you're trying to do. An example of a purpose statement is leave it better than you found it. That's like an actual family purpose statement that a family has created. No one is going to, at no point is the family going to say, well, I think we've left enough things better than we found them, right? But it's a way of communicating how you want people to think about these problems. You could apply that to like the environment. You could apply it to the people that you're around. You could apply it to the generation. You could apply it to company. You could apply it to a million different things. I think that's what really makes a good purpose statement, is
Sure.
the kind of inspirational broadness of it all.
Yeah.
But that's how we think about purpose and like going forward for us.
That makes a ton of sense. So I'm curious then, you're dealing with a lot of wealth managers here. What's their response been, or have you gotten any anecdotes or anything of how that's improved, I guess, the relationships with their clients?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about these assets transferring, and so there's a to some extent that's out of your control, I think, and you're kind of just sitting around waiting. You're like, oh man, when Adam passes, is he gonna, are his kids gonna move or not? And so to us, we're trying to get them to think about what they can control, which to us is the percentage of multi-generational relationships. It's the number one thing we tell the advisors to track that they're probably not tracking. A handful of them are, like, under 20%, I would say. Where if you just said, how many of all your client relationships, how many of them are multi-generational? If you don't know that number, you should definitely figure it out. And then that's something we can start to work on, because we don't know if it's going to transfer, but okay, let's just say today it's 15% of our relationships. Maybe there's a couple key ones that we really want to make sure they're multi-generational because it's a large chunk of our assets. Or maybe just across the board, we want to take that number from 15 to 25 in the next couple of years, and then from 25 to 50 in the next 5 years. So I think that's where we're pushing them, is to worry less about what's going to happen, because like you can control making an effort to get to know the heirs, the children, the grandchildren, the spouses. You can make an effort to do those things proactively and try to like find a leading metric that to us matters a lot. So I think that is one piece of in terms of like what we're telling the advisors to consider implementing. When you talk about legacy, you also sound really different than an advisor. If I'm just saying like, Adam, we do, really good financial planning, that kind of sounds similar as of what you'd hear. To your point about AI, maybe I can financially plan better than AI, maybe, but that's not probably who I would bet on if I had to guess at the rate these tools are improving. So when you sound different and you talk to your clients about these different things, when they're talking to their friends and they're like, yeah, I was working with my advisor, we did this this family values activity with my adult kids, and it was a really cool conversation, and I never knew that my oldest son prioritized entrepreneurship so much, and it was so cool because like that's what blah blah, like a story like that. We had this happen where an advisor got a $50 million referral, client with $50 million in assets. Their friends introduced them after sharing their experience. They had no idea how wealthy their friends were. They were very just low key kind of people. But when they heard that story about like intergenerational communication, they said, are you supposed to be doing this with your wealth advisor? And they were like, I don't know, but we did it with ours. Are you not doing anything like that? And so to us, there's also a differentiation. I sometimes say, like, my kids are 5, 3, and 1. I sometimes say in 10 years, they're going to ask us, like, well, what did wealth advisors do before they did legacy work? And I'm going to have to tell them, like, no, they did financial planning and they did all this stuff with the numbers. And so they're like, really? It isn't, don't the AIs do that? Yeah, the AIs do it now. They used to do it. And so to us, it feels like this is the, we're certainly betting heavily that this is the direction of the industry. And a lot of advisors embrace it. I mean, I think we're still early. A lot of advisors don't. A lot of advisors are like, look, I'm a money guy. I pick the stocks, I fill up the bank kind of thing. And so that's probably not like our target advisor. But there's a lot of, multifamily offices and family offices have been doing this work for a really long time, not at scale, but for a really long time. And they don't lose clients. It's, well, those numbers about clients leaving, this isn't, the best multifamily offices in the country. They lose no one. And one of the reasons is because that family feels like this person and or firm understands our legacy. That is different than Adam manages my money. Like if you're introducing your kids and you're like, hey, I want you to meet our firm, this person understands the legacy of our family. It's like, wow, really? That's cool. That's different than, I manage money and put it in funds and whatever. So I think we're seeing a lot of advisors really embrace this work. There's lots of, cool organizations and companies trying to help advisors do it. And we have large partnerships with a lot of the large financial institutions. At the end of the day, if the advisor doesn't believe in it, it's just not going to totally work because there is a learning curve. When you're like talking to someone about their values, there's a learning curve in that type of stuff, but it's not insurmountable. It's just a little discomfort. And then after a couple reps, just like your first financial plan that you discussed, you probably weren't the most comfortable as you were on financial plan number 100 or whatever.
You just have to learn a new skill. Change is hard, especially for people that have been doing similar things. But certainly, I think with AI, we all have to maybe be a little reflective and say, how do we need to continue to grow, change, evolve at the pace of change I see across industry? It's a breakneck pace, and it's hard. But you know,
I
the
mean, on that growth, like growth is one of the values of our company.
yeah.
And I'm just, you know, if you're not leaning into this stuff, you probably don't work at Total Family.
Sure.
And I think it's like a mix of pushing the team out of their comfort zone and just like checking in periodically to just be like, hey, I know I'm pushing you really hard on all this type of stuff. Like, because the compounding, like our human brains just can't, we're not going to be able to keep up.
Right, we're the governor.
Right.
It's like human
Right.
capacity.
Exactly. Totally.
Totally.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But just sort of refusing to try new things, refusing to rethink how you're doing something, probably won't fly in most young companies, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. You said one thing that I want to repeat back that really resonated with me. That was like, you know, we often think of legacy as like, you know, the matriarch, patriarch telling stories down to younger generations. But you had mentioned something about the older generations learning something about the younger generations that they didn't know before. And that direction of learning too, just hit a chord with me because it just broke a paradigm, I guess, in my head. So I just wanted to call that out.
Yeah. Oh, good. I mean, you know, so we define personal vision as values, purpose, and roles. Values are what's important to you. Purpose is your North Star, as we talked about. And then roles are the areas in your life that are most important. And I've never, you know, as someone who has three kids, I haven't met any parent who doesn't want a better relationship with their kids. That doesn't mean that your relationship is bad, right? Like your relationship can be a 7 or an 8 and you want it to be a 9, or a 4 or 5 and you want it to be a 6. And I also don't think a lot of young people ever feel understood by their parents. This might be true for our entire lives, you know, where your parents are like, sort of think you're one way or whatever, but your friends understand you in a different way.
Yeah.
And everyone just has this like deep desire to be understood. And to us, personal vision and some of these like frameworks that we built in give a family a way to like elevate their communication. You know, because if your parents were just like, all right, Adam, well, let us understand you that if we don't understand you, you know, and you're like backed into a corner, like you're like, actually, well, let me start with like my values and my purpose and the roles in my life that are really important to me.
Yeah.
And like if everyone is sort of going down that journey of feeling a little bit more understood, to me, that's like a cool thing to do for people.
It is a very impactful thing that you're working on for sure. Just in this conversation, it's really getting my mind kind of spinning. But I'm trying to think of a really good analogy. So similar to like doctors, if I'm thinking healthcare, right? You have doctors, you have specialists, and they just look at this one little narrow sliver of like your health. But in effect, if you think about total wellness in general, right? It's like, what are you eating? You know, what are your stress levels? You know, what are the interpersonal relationships you have that are fulfilling in all these ways that have, you know, very tangible health like effects.
Yep.
You know, and there's no one in the healthcare industry looking at the total picture necessarily. And in my mind, that's kind of what you're kind of building is you're building this thing that is about total family wellness. As you mentioned earlier, to kind of go back, finances and money is only one sliver of that, but there's all these other elements that are disconnected. So I'm curious, is that an accurate representation, or how do you really kind of like paint the big picture of your product?
Maybe if we go back to Jay Hughes's 5 forms of family capital for a second, I'll
Yeah.
just rattle those off just for the people who maybe are unfamiliar. There's 5 of them. The first one is cultural capital. That's how we do things around here, kind of the ethos of the family.
Okay.
Next is social capital, which is how we make decisions in our relationships. Intellectual capital is the stories and the shared knowledge of our family. shared is very important. So if your grandpa has the knowledge in his head and he doesn't speak to anyone, that doesn't count. We need to teach it and learn it. And human capital is the physical and mental health of the family. The fifth one is financial. So I think in a lot of ways, we are focused very heavily on the non-financial aspects of it. You know, how we, I think like how we've gotten approval. I know there's like other entrepreneurs listening to this, but like how we've gotten approval at a lot of these larger financial institutions is we don't take any of the high risk data. We're not taking social security numbers. We don't take balances. We don't take account numbers. We don't take legal documents, you know, like all the things that are really stress out compliance departments. We sort of just avoid those. And these other four capitals to us, like we're not the only provider that is thinking about them. Like it could be your, you know, personal trainer is helping you in human capital or your therapist. So I think like people, once you see that framework, then as a family, you can say, okay, how do we take our financial capital and strengthen these other areas? Because I don't think anyone's signing up for, I have tons of money and I don't like, am disconnected and have horrible relationships with all the people in my life. Like, I don't think anyone's signing up for that. So you can take money and do things like, you know, buy dinner for people in your family. That's an investment in your social capital. Calling your siblings are like, I don't want to go to dinner. It's like, it's a good restaurant. I'm buying. They're like, all right, fine, I'll come, you know, or a family vacation or an escape room or a software like ours. It doesn't really matter. These are all investments into these other areas that I think do add up to a nicer picture of well-being for people. You alluded to like the end of life connection. There's a book called The Good Life by Robert Waldinger, and he runs the Harvard Study of Adult Development. And it's the longest running study on human happiness, basically. It's like 80, might be close to 90 years now. Essentially, they just found that at the end of life, relationships matter. That's what they found. You know, if you want to listen to like the people who are 70, 80, 90 years old, looking eternity in the face, all they're thinking about is the relationships. And I think there's a really important lesson in there for all of us.
Yeah, you can't take money with you, but you have memories. I mean, that's the most
Yeah.
important part. This is great. I could wax philosophy with you all day, Alex, but I want to kind of wrap up the episode here, but I have a couple final questions for you. You know, being a founder is hard. This is an incredibly like valiant mission-aligned effort, right? I think that it strokes both the business side of me, but also some like, personal things for me. So I'm just curious, if you had to give a piece of advice to another founder trying to do something that is they're similarly passionate about, like what would that be?
I think there's probably two things that, or maybe I'll say three things. The first is like subtracting out that's not helping you. When you have kids and you have three of them, you're forced to like things just subtract out of your life. People are like, "Do you see the game last night?" I'm like, "I don't even know what you're talking about, honestly." You know, so some things just get taken out for you.
Sure.
But I got off social media, I don't know, like 7 or 8 years ago, maybe even a little bit longer. And so that's, you know, the average young person is spending between like 6 and 8 hours a day on their phone.
Wild.
So it's like you could pretty much learn like Mandarin if you just devoted that time to something else. So I think subtracting out gives you some room. And then I just haven't met any really successful, interesting people that don't read a lot. So to me, there's something in books, whether they be, you know, audio, however you're reading books, however you can read the most books possible, That should be your, I do a lot of audiobooks because, like, a lot of dishes, a lot of cleaning, a lot of like holding a baby and walking around at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's like not, it's actually not my favorite thing in the world, but with the right audiobook, you get through it. So subtracting out the stuff that's not helping you, reading a ton is really going to help. And then the last thing I think is just like whatever you can do to be grateful. There's an exercise called grateful flow that we talk about a lot, where you just start to write down all the stuff. It helps if you take, if you start with the things you're taking for granted. So you're like, I'm grateful that I don't have cancer. I'm grateful that I'm not in a war-torn country. I'm grateful that I can pay my electric bill. I'm grateful that, my family has enough food. I'm grateful that I have 10 fingers and 10 toes. And you just go down this path because it's really lonely being a founder in the early days, especially when you're trying to do something as novel as what Total Family is doing. Most people just thought I was insane. Just like, I have no idea what you're talking about, man. Sounds good. Best of luck to you and your family, kind of thing. And so you have to be able to like take in the feedback. I think that's helpful because that exists, but also not let the negativity come in where all of a sudden you're like not believing in what you're doing anymore. And so to me, like finding ways, whether it's journal, grateful flow, like finding ways to work through the ups and downs of that on a day-to-day basis. I also was just sharing this with another executive in our company that like, if you're having a bad day, you have those days where you're like, the email comes in, it's horrible news. Another email comes in, it's horrible. You get a text, it's bad. You lose the deal. This happens, whatever. Like those days, I've learned I literally just stop working because I don't want to compound, have my mistakes start compounding. So now I'm gonna respond to, my wife and start a fight. Then I'm gonna say something, snippy to my friend. Then I'm gonna say something to a client that I probably wouldn't have said. I just shut it down. Like, you know what? I know one thing. Today is not my day. And so I don't want to play any more hands on that day. I just shut it down, try to get a good night's sleep, and wake up really early and start fresh instead of compounding the mistakes. 'Cause the bad days, you know this, they happen.
Absolutely. Unavoidable. This is great advice, Alex. Very much appreciate you sharing that. Final question. Also, founders can't do it alone. You've already alluded to some of the great team members you have and some of the attributes that you look for, but give a shout out or who are you building this with and who are you thankful to have on your team?
Well, I don't want to. I was thinking about this. I don't want to say any sort of specific people on the team, other than the fact that, like, the group that we have is the most talented group of people I've ever worked with. As a founder, it's like it was my idea to start the company, but all of these people have shaped every single thing beyond that initial thought, right? Where I'm like, from our software to our chief of staff to our, every single person is, they're like, Alex, what are you talking about? This doesn't make sense. We need to do it like this. It's like, so you have these wonderful people that are believing in what you're trying to get the world to do. We've found that sort of two things are like above, actually I can probably share all this. I don't think it's like that revolutionary, but if they don't love legacy, if they don't really believe in the purpose, it's not going to work. If they're not a self-starter, I mean, we could probably do a whole podcast on like the HR policies that we have at Total Family, but we don't have hours. We don't have PTO. We just treat everyone like full-on adults. And we need you to do great work and get it done and not leave our clients hanging and not leave your teammates hanging. And that's kind of our only guidelines. So if you can't wake up and just get your stuff done at whatever time. You know, we have like working moms that need to get kids off the bus. We have, single people in New York. We have like, people in different time zones. Like, I don't care if you're at your desk at 9. If your flexibility is a direct result of your reliability, and everyone on our team is 100% reliable. So they're 100% flexible in my mind. And then just something we started doing like in the last couple of years, I suck at interviewing. I just like everyone. I'm like, oh, we should hire Adam. He's perfect. So we do a project hire where we give someone like some money and a small project. And then after that, we do a more in-depth project that could be like 90 days to 6-ish months. And if they make it through both those things, we hire them. And it gives a chance of everyone to work with the person. It gets us a chance to see what they're like, what their work product's like. Are they a self-starter? Are they creative? Are they using AI? Are they doing all these things? And some people have made it through step one and not two. We haven't really had anyone who's made it through both, and then we've like it hasn't worked. But that's been a like making bad hires is can be really draining on a company. And
Absolutely.
so I think we just kind of all threw our hands up and said, like, no one really feels like they're that good at it. So let's just find a way to, we risk a little bit of money, but eventually, like, I think it's that strategy has really helped us. And it's not like you need to be unanimous, but I think for the most part, almost all of our hires are unanimous with everyone who's gotten a chance to work with them, say like, really great to work with. They're a high quality teammate, they're doing high quality stuff, kind of thing.
I love it, Alex. You've granted our listeners some strategy, some tactics. Hopefully some people pulled some good nuggets out of the conversation today. So I thank you very much for joining me. And to our listeners, this has been another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast Accelerate Series. Alex Kirby, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thanks.
Right. Until next time, take care. Well, that's a wrap on this episode of the Innovators and Investors Accelerate series. The road to seed and Series A has never been more complex, but as we heard today, the opportunities for AI-native startups to disrupt the status quo has never been greater. If you enjoyed this deep dive, make sure to check out our main podcast feed at finstratmgmt.com/podcast, where we host broader conversations on the intersection of finance, strategy, and innovation. There, you'll find our full library of episodes and resources designed to help you scale smarter. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review if you found today's insights valuable. I'm Adam Chen. Thanks for listening. We'll see you on the next episode.